Those who haven't thought through the dilemma that is climate change often see the answer in nuclear power. Their first argument, and it's correct, is it's emissions free. It produces no carbon dioxide emissions in its primary sense. Of course, it's far more complicated than that. Nuclear power requires, beyond anything else, a social license. It needs the permission of the community to be built. And of course, the other issue that needs to be considered, it's going to take a long time, and we simply don't have the time. It could take 10, 15, maybe even 20 years to get a nuclear plant up and operating successfully in Australia. We just haven't got the time. Figures also demonstrate nuclear power is an expensive way to find the energy the world needs. Yes, welcome to this latest episode of Climate Conversations. I'm your host, Robert McLean. This podcast is assembled here in Shepparton in northern Victoria, Australia, on the lands of the Yorta Yorta people. Yes, the stolen lands of the Yorta Yorta people, and I pay my respects to their elders, past, present and emerging. A question about nuclear power was posed to last night's Q&A session on the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, last night being April 29. And the question was handled by the host, Patricia Carvalis, and then you hear from several of the panel. Let's have a listen now.
Hello. CSIRO has determined nuclear power does not currently provide an economically competitive solution in Australia. So why do we even consider it?
Mark Speakman, I'll start with you.
Thanks.
Well, your previous New South Wales government was seen as really, you know, leading the country in many ways on a lot of these sort of climate change policies. Do you think there's a place for nuclear?
Well, I don't think we should rule it out. I don't think any technology should be off the table. And if there's a ban at the moment, as there is, that ban should be lifted. That said, most experts will say that it's at least 15 or 20 years before you could get a nuclear facility up and running in Australia. We know we are facing enormous challenges in getting clean, reliable, ample, affordable energy supply in the next few years. We can't wait for nuclear, so in the meantime, here in New South Wales, we should be going ahead with our electricity roadmap, which will have heavy reliance on renewables.
And so, do you think it's worth pursuing it as a sort of policy, as the federal government is doing?
Technology can change, costs can change, so there should not be a ban on it. But in the meantime, because there is an urgency in making sure we've got clean and reliable and affordable energy, we need to get on with the rollout of renewables.
One thing that doesn't change is what do you do with the pollution that's from it, you know? Where do you store that? That's not going to change.
Well, that's a fair point, but that's a point for independent assessment, environmental assessment in the future. It's not a reason to put it off the table now.
OK. Bridget, there's obviously a big debate in your party about this.
There's no debate in my party about this.
Just about where to put it.
No debate.
Is there really no debate?
So, okay,
there's a debate.
I was at COP28 in Dubai in December where the IPCC, the IEA has said for the globe to get to net zero by 2050, nuclear has to be part of the solution. We need to triple nuclear energy production globally to actually get there as a globe. Now, we are kidding ourselves if we don't think our country, with an AUKUS alliance, is not going to be have nuclear over coming decades. That is going to be a reality. We think it should be part of the mix to 2050, absolutely, because renewables aren't going to be able to
deliver. Who's going to have it in their backyard? And when are you going to tell us where the sites will be?
Because well, we will be announcing our policy well in time for the next election.
And will you be specific about
locations? Including locations. But the fact is, Labor's target, we're not going to get to their target by 2030. And so to say it's not going to be able to be delivered, you know, for 10 or 15 years, we want this to have cheap, reliable energy. AEMO, the Grattan Institute, everybody says the path we're on, 100% renewable, will not work. We will not get there. We will have blackouts.
But
it's not Mackenzie saying it.
No,
it's not the National Party.
But
it's the experts.
The economic part of the question there, that no one is saying that this is a cheap solution. Or that, that
well,
it's a
fast
solution.
Well, nor is 100,000 kilometres of new transmission lines either that don't have social licence, that are going to cost a fortune, and you can't get through the planning laws.
But if you're struggling getting social licence for those transmission lines, how are you going to get them for nuclear reactors?
Well, I think the Australians...
But honestly, it's a question about...
I know which faction everybody's in the audience now. But
the faction, PK asked a good question.
No, PK, the fact is that those countries, like all our G20 competitors globally, you want a manufacturing industry, the G20 are either have nuclear or are in the plans to actually get it set up, except for us. Germany, France, Canada, America, the UK.
Germany just shut them.
Yes. I don't know which untruth to pick up on there, because... Peter Dutton was picked up on this in Insiders. He's been making the claim that all the G20 countries
have nuclear... No, not all
the nuclear.
G20, I said, are on a pathway to get it.
Germany is getting out of it. Italy is getting out of it. Indonesia doesn't have it and doesn't have plans to.
Yes, it does.
You say 100,000 kilometres of transmission lines. Last week it was 28,000 was the claim being made. It's actually 4,000 till 2030. But, like...
Murray...
Patricia, you make the good point that...
I'm talking about the difficulty of the social licence.
Well, you make a good point. There is a debate on in the National Party and the Liberal Party at the moment about this, particularly about the locations, because they are the new NIMBYs. They don't want nuclear in their backyards. They want it everywhere else, but not in their electorate. I mean, scientists took 13 years to split the atom. Peter Dutton has managed to split the coalition on this in 13 days. 13 days.
Murray,
efficient.
When are you going to front up after report, energy expert after energy expert says you are not going to meet your 2030 emissions reduction targets or your renewable rollout for 2030?
Well, the Nationals never wanted an emissions reduction target and still
don't.
So
what I'm going to do is press park and we're going to revisit this with you two, because, boy, oh, boy, wasn't that...
I'd love to have another discussion about nuclear.
All right, we'll do
Me
it.
Me too.
That's good. You're both enthusiastic.
Bridget McKenzie has a history of playing rather loosely with the truth, and so that throws into doubt immediately all her prognostications and the support for nuclear power. Now we have the audio from a story from WA Today. It has the headline, Charged Up, WA Town to Home Australia's Biggest Battery. The story is by Peter Milne. Here is the audio now.
An expansion to a battery in Collie to store midday solar power collected on the state's biggest power grid for use in the evening will make it Australia's largest energy storage site. The expansion is to serve a two-year storage contract from October 2025 that French firm Neoen won after a competitive tender run by the Australian energy market operator that controls the power grid in southwest WA. Kate Ryan, AEMO manager for WA, welcomed the investment. Neoen's Collie battery will play an important role as we navigate through WA's energy transition, supporting the state's future energy needs as coal-fired generation retires, she said. The WA government's 2023 budget allocated $2.8 billion for energy storage, wind generation and upgrades to the transmission system. Supplying power to the state's populous southwest is getting increasingly complex as demand rises. Continuing installation of rooftop solar panels causes a difficult-to-manage midday power supply peak, and slow progress is made in building new wind farms. Substantial amounts of additional renewable and gas generation are needed before state-owned power generator Synergy closes its last two coal-fired power plants in 2027 and 2029. Neoen is building Stage 1 of its Collie battery after winning a similar contract in mid-2023. It is planned to start operating by December 2024 and will be able to charge or discharge 200 megawatts over 4 hours. The French firm also operates Australia's original grid-scale battery at Hornsdale in South Australia and the Victorian Big Battery. Together with the 300 megawatts, the Collie site will be able to store or supply 20% of the average demand on the Southwest interconnected system. Both stages will be constructed by UGL, a subsidiary of German-controlled construction contractor CIMIC. Elon Musk's Tesla will supply the batteries, including 348 megapacks for Stage 2. About 150 workers will be required to build Stage 2. Neoen's first Collie contract was so lucrative that it upgraded its earnings forecast by about $160 million the day it was announced. Energy utility Alinta is building a 100-megawatt battery at Wagerup. Synergy commissioned a 100-megawatt battery in industrial Kwinana in 2023. A second stage under construction will be able to store an additional 200 megawatts that can be charged or discharged over 4 hours.
Next, we have the audio from a story in the Melbourne Age. It has the headline, Dangerous Heat Kills Dozens, Closes Schools, Prompts 4-Day Work Week. You'll find a link to that story in the show notes.
Manila, the Philippines has cancelled in-person public school classes for the next 2 days and said the power grid on its main island could be strained as the country grapples with a heat wave that is also affecting other parts of Southeast Asia. The state weather agency said the heat index, which measures the temperature felt by individuals as it takes humidity into account, was expected to remain at a record 45 degrees, in the range which it classes as dangerous, as conditions can trigger heat stroke from prolonged exposure. On Monday, it was expected to reach as high as 46 degrees in Manila. It could continue hitting record highs until the second week of May, Glazer Escalar, a state weather forecaster, told DZBB radio station. The heat wave is putting pressure on power supplies on the main island of Luzon, which accounts for 3/4 of economic output, with reserves thinning after 13 power plants had shut down earlier this month, the Philippines grid operator said in a statement. The government urged people to save electricity. A provincial government in the main Luzon island will implement a 4-day work week through July to mitigate the impact of high temperatures on its employees and the public. In Indonesia, warmer temperatures have been cited as a factor in a surge in cases of dengue fever, a mosquito-borne infection, to 35,000 cases last month from 15,000 a year earlier. In Thailand, power demand reached a record 36,356 megawatts late on Saturday, the Ministry of Energy said. The country's northern and northeastern regions are expected to be the hottest, with a high of 44 degrees recorded in some areas on Sunday. Bangkok issued extreme heat warnings last week as its index was listed as above 52 degrees and very dangerous on Sunday. About 30 people have died due to the high temperatures so far this year in Thailand, compared with 37 heat-linked fatalities in all of 2023, according to government data. The Metropolitan Administration urged people to avoid outdoor activities. The same statement has been repeated daily since April 20. The highest temperature ever recorded in Thailand was 44.6 C in both 2016 and 2023, according to the Meteorological Department. Soaring heat and drought have been felt in recent weeks from India, which is carrying out the world's largest election in temperatures that have risen above 40 degrees, to the coffee plantations of Vietnam. Earlier this month, the United Nations Children's Fund warned that more than 243 million children across East Asia and the Pacific are at risk of heat-related illnesses and death, as the region braces for an unusually hot summer. The El Niño weather pattern has prolonged the dry season and hotter temperatures have accelerated the mosquito life cycle, Indonesian Health Ministry spokesperson Siti Nadia Tarmizi told state media Antara News Agency. The Philippines Education Ministry on Sunday ordered public schools to shift to online learning due to the record heat index forecast, as classrooms can be crowded and most do not have air conditioning. Benjo Bassas, chairperson of Teachers Dignity Coalition, a group of educators, said the extreme heat was already taking a toll on teachers and students. We already have reports of high blood pressure and dizziness, and fainting for pupils and teachers in the past days, Bassas told DWPM radio station. Several private schools and universities not covered by the ministry mandate have also shifted to online classes. More than 3.6 million public school students were already affected from similar suspensions of schooling last week. Passengers at Manila's main airport are also struggling with temperatures inside the Terminal 3 building after two of its 6 cooling towers stopped working on Sunday. Evaporative fans were being used to improve circulation and offer respite to passengers, the airport authority said on Monday. Reuters, Bloomberg.
This pains me no end, but driven by the old reporter in me, I feel obliged to give Peter Dutton some oxygen. Peter Dutton is the opposition leader in Australia. I have a story here from Sky News, and here is the audio. The headline of the story is, Peter Dutton calls for government to engage in mature conversation on nuclear energy. I know I'm terribly biased, but I'm not sure he would understand what a mature conversation really is. Let's listen to him now.
weeks ago, we had a giant protest here against seismic blasting in the Otway Basin. Dan Tehan spoke about it, saying that he thought the project was too big in scope. I was wondering if you had a view on it.
Well, obviously we have environmental standards, which are very important, and the expectation, the legal requirement is that they be abided by. We need gas, obviously. That's a reality of our economy as we transition into a new energy system. We need to make sure that we've got gas, and if you look to a business like this, they require electricity and gas to manufacture and to produce. That's just a reality. Now, we've spoken about the government's renewables only policy, and as we know in a business like this, the solar panels are great during the daytime, but they don't work over night time, and you need to firm up that power. By 2034, we know that 90% of the firming power in our system, that is the 24/7 power, is going out of the system. And so we're going to have a big gap, which is why the energy regulators are saying that we're likely to see blackouts and brownouts and a continuation of price escalation, that is higher electricity bills and higher gas bills under this government's policy. And that's why we think there should be a mature conversation about having nuclear in the system, which is zero emissions. It's latest technology. It's adopted by 19 of the 20 G20 countries. Australia is the only one of the 20 biggest economies in the world not to have nuclear, or not to have signed up to having nuclear in their system to firm up renewables. I'm a very strong supporter of renewables, but they can't work 24/7. I want to believe that the battery can last longer than 2 hours, but the current technology just means that it can't. Well, this factory here would run on batteries. So we need to have a proper, mature conversation. I believe that we can have greener energy. I think we can have more secure and reliable energy, and we can have cheaper electricity if we have nuclear in the mix. The other point, of course, is that the government can't get its way to its international commitments of net zero by 2050 without having the latest generation zero emissions nuclear power in the mix. That's just a hard scientific fact. And so we'll continue this debate. The government can pretend that the lights will stay on, but under Labor, your power bills are going to continue to go up, and there is a greater likelihood that we'll see blackouts and brownouts. And think about a shop like this or a factory like this. You can't have a situation where the power is coming on and off. Whilst you're baking sourdough, you can't have a situation where the ovens go off for 20 minutes and then come back on. Businesses just can't work like that. And that's why we're seeing businesses leave Australia at the moment and go offshore, and then we just re-import the product back into Australia.
And now we have two 90-second segments from Yale Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. Off the coast of Rhode Island, anglers fish for striped bass, fluke, and mahi-mahi.
Recreational angling is a prominent, very important use of our coastal waters. It is an economically, socially, culturally important activity.
So Tiffany Smythe of the United States Coast Guard Academy says it's important to know how anglers feel about fishing near offshore wind turbines. Her team surveyed about 200 recreational anglers about the Block Island Wind Farm, the nation's first offshore wind farm.
We found overall a neutral to positive effect of this wind farm project on recreational angling.
She says many of those surveyed believe the turbines improve fishing. Respondents say the bases of the turbines attract fish, like artificial reefs. But some expressed concerns about this or future wind projects. For example, whether they would interfere with fishing access or cause crowding. So Smythe says it's important to include anglers in siting and planning decisions for offshore wind farms.
From the very, very first days that the ideas are even floated.
So turbines and fishing boats can successfully share the seas. Above the Arctic Circle, in Kotzebue, Alaska, college students and community members are growing greens, potatoes, and beans in campus gardens.
I think it's very important that we can grow our own.
Minnie Naylor is director of the University of Alaska Fairbanks Chukchi campus. She says homegrown vegetables can help supplement traditional native foods.
We have bearded seal, caribou, we have a lot of fish, sea fish, trout, birds, ducks, geese.
but many of those foods are becoming more difficult to access. The growth of the commercial fishing industry, restrictive hunting regulations, and other pressures have interfered with subsistence hunting and fishing. And climate change brings new problems. Melting sea ice makes it harder to hunt seal, and warming waters are shifting where fish species can thrive. Meanwhile, food shipped to the region is pricey. So as part of the Food Security and Sovereignty Project, students and other volunteers are growing food using hydroponics and other methods. They're learning what works in their short growing season and sharing knowledge with others, so Native Alaskans can have more options for affordable food close to home. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Yes, we've reached the end of this episode of Climate Conversations. Thanks so much, Vic Hamby. It's been great to have you along. Now, come Friday, I'm talking with Professor Andrew Blakers. Andrew Blakers has been a long-time advocate for renewable energy. I'm looking forward to that, and I trust you will be there with me. So please watch out for that. As I said, we're at the end of this episode of Climate Conversations, and again, thank you for your company. Now, I'd love you to follow this podcast, because if you do that, you'll be alerted every time I publish a new episode. And beyond that, please share this with your friends, because we need everybody to know everything that's going on, or as much as they can possibly know about the climate crisis. Because to change everything, we need everyone. Also, I'd love to know what you think about this podcast, so please contact me at r.mclean7@icloud.com. Don't hold back. Good or bad, please let me know. Beyond all that, I'd love to have your voice on this podcast, so using that email address, contact me and I can contact you via phone or via Zoom and we can have a chat about your views on the climate crisis. Now, please don't forget to check out the show notes because you'll find links for there and as many stories as I can fit. Yes, please check them out. Make some decisions and decide what you're going to do to help resolve the climate crisis. Now, until we talk again, please take care, stay safe, and please be kind. Everyone you meet is fighting a great battle. Now take care and stay safe.